It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, 12 years after the B5 premiere. The Babylon podcast was a dream given form, its goal to discuss Babylon 5 episodes, arcs, and implications, to interview the cast and crew about their experiences and memories. It's a home away from home for fanboys, geek girls, and lurkers. It can be a silly place, but it's our last best hope for B5 fans. This is the podcast about the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2006. The name of this show is the Babylon Podcast.
Welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
And once again, Jeffrey Willerth has set us up with a mystery guest. I have no idea who it's going to be, but we'll give the assigned phone number a call and find out who we're talking to.
And Jeffrey, of course, is not even here to register our reactions, whatever that may be. So
he will hear it later, but yes, he's in between here and El Salvador now, right, with his other work, so.
He's a busy Vorlon.
And we will also be talking about the pilot episode for Babylon 5, The Gathering.
Looking forward to that discussion. Just watched it a few days ago.
Yes, and I have 2 pages of notes comparing the differences between the original airing of the pilot and the re-edited version that aired on TNT. And that is the re-edited version is the only version that's out there on DVD now.
Now, I saw the version I saw was the two-sided disc that also had In the Beginning. I also understand now there's a DVD version of The Gathering also gathered within The Beginning and the other 3 TNT movies, and I don't know how those packages compare.
It is actually the same movie, the same version. The original edit of the pilot, I believe, JMS might have stashed it away somewhere, but I have it because I got it on Laserdisc. Yes, Laserdisc. Japanese import. When did I get that? Probably 1.5 years after it aired.
How'd you manage to get a hold of that?
I used to collect movies on Laserdisc. People were, you know, some people did beta. I went LD, mainly because of my Japanese animation addiction. So I had plenty of contacts in the Japanese Laserdisc import world, and we didn't have to worry about things not working in certain regions.
Technology, it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. That's why we have to keep buying certain albums 5 or 6 different times every time a new media format comes out. All right, let's find out who our mystery guest is.
Hello.
Hi, this is Summer Brooks with the Babylon Podcast. We're supposed to have an interview.
Yes, hi, Summer. This is Pat Tallman.
Hi, Pat. How are you?
Good.
Hi, Pat. This is Tim Callender with the Babylon Podcast. How are you?
I'm well. I'm walking out of my son's karate class, and I'm going to go over here where I'll be actually able to hear you. How are you guys? Where are you anyway?
We are in Phoenix. Well, I am in Phoenix.
Oh, okay.
I'm in Richmond, Virginia.
Oh, isn't technology marvelous?
It's marvelous when it works, but we were wrestling with it.
Yeah, exactly. So, you guys didn't know it was going to be me today?
I did not.
Oh, that's so funny. Jeffrey sent me an email saying, "Now this is all great and so good for you to do, and you know, thanks for doing it, and yet they're not going to know it's you." And I'm thinking, well, okay.
Are they
going to be happy about it?
That's generally been Jeffrey's MO with this whole thing. He's fed us the numbers, and then we'll call in, and then we have no clue who we're talking to until they say, "Hi, this is."
Okay. Okay. But that doesn't really give you a chance to prepare or decide what you want to talk about.
Well, Pat, I'll tell you what. This is a good starting off point. We were going to be discussing The Gathering, which of course is the pilot for Babylon 5.
Uh-huh.
And You appeared in that initial pilot. However, you did not reappear in Babylon 5 until midway through the second year. Can you give us some insight as to why you were not included in the
Joe really liked me, and he created the character of Leda around Barbara from Night of the Living Dead, which is a character I played in the 1990 version of George Romero's cult classic from the 60s. And so when I came into audition, it was a huge surprise to me, because I read The Gathering, and I thought, they're going to get big star names for these parts, especially such a fabulous character like Leda, and I didn't think I stood a chance. And I was in the outer office waiting to go in, kind of going over. You get what's called a side, which is they choose what scenes or what part of scenes they want you to read for the audition, and then you go in, and there's usually the casting director sits there, and they'll have sometimes the casting assistant will read the sides with you. So you're not reading with another actor, you're just reading with an assistant. And it's up to you to sort of flesh that out and make that work. And so, you know, there's a lot of mind games you play with yourself before you go into the office situation, so that you can be creating this environment of a space station or whatever it is that you're doing. And Mary Jo Slater was cast the pilot. She's a big casting person. And they did us the huge favor of hiring Ed Wasser, who's a wonderful actor. I don't know if you remember him as Mr. Morden on the series.
Oh, absolutely.
He read with us. So it was incredible to get a chance to at least read with an actor. Right before I went in, this big, tall man, all wearing black, comes rushing into the room, fills the entire door frame. He's just a really tall guy, and he says, "Patricia Tallman," and I look up, and he said, "My name's Joe Straczynski. I wrote the part for you. Good luck." And he leaves. And I'm just standing there completely horrified, and there's one other actor in the room with me, and he goes, "No pressure, huh?" I don't even really remember the rest of the audition process, but this is all a long story to tell you that Joe wanted me for the part, and I was confident in that, but some other suits from Warner Brothers didn't want me in the part. They didn't think I was sexy enough, and when they got the chance, they gave me the axe, and they brought in...
Andrea Thompson.
Thank you. Oh my gosh, senior moment. Who was wonderful, but the gracious thing that Joe did for me was he didn't give her Leda. He wrote her. He created her a new role, so that later, when the chance arose, he was able to bring me back in as my character still. So that's the long and short of it.
How did they get back in touch with you to return to be Leda?
He just called me. Out of the blue, he called me out of the blue and said, "Andrea's thinking of leaving, and I have a storyline that involves the Vorlons, and so we could bring you back. Would you be interested?" And I said, "Gee, let me think. Yeah, you know, yeah." My son was 5 months old at that point, and it was kind of perfect timing.
Right, because I know he had to have had a Joe had to have had a special place in his heart for your character, because in the original Babylon 5 Writer's Bible says, "Don't do anything with Leda as a love interest. I have something in mind. You're not going to find out till much later."
Right. And well, he had asked me if I minded if Leda was gay. And I said, "Absolutely not. That's totally fine." So I think there was, you know, that things got switched around. He had to be very flexible as actors came and went. But he would keep some of the same intent for the series, and somehow it just would morph over into other characters if somebody was there or wasn't there.
I was going to ask you, what was the most difficult part of playing Leda?
Bad things kept happening to her. she didn't get a chance to be real happy. I mean, it wasn't until the fifth season when... she was starting to have that love affair that she actually cracked a smile. I mean, I remember it clearly, thinking, "Oh my gosh, it's the first time I really laughed on the show." And only 5 years later. Huh. Kind of weird. Yeah, so, you know, I mean, it was constantly, I'd get a script on my doorstep and read it and think, "Oh my God, gills? you know, or whatever it was. It's just, what's going on now? This is unbelievable. So she wasn't a happy little camper, you know. She just had all these weird things happening. And I didn't really know a lot about how she'd been altered by the Vorlons. So I kind of had to keep it kind of neutral and mysterious because I wasn't really clear on it. Joe didn't let us know anything until the script came out.
Do you have any interesting anecdotes relating to your interaction with Walter Koenig and the little sparring matches between Lita and Bester?
Oh, I loved working with Walter. He's a serious classic actor, and I got the biggest kick out of him. At first, I didn't know how to take him because he's got this very kind of dry sense of humor, and I think there might be a little testing that goes on from Walter as the actor to anybody else he has to work with. I think he kind of slyly lets his sense of humor out little at a time and sees how you take it. And he's very mischievous. He would tell us later about practical jokes they played on Star Trek that would have people going for days, just day hours and days, these jokes they would drag out. And he kind of did that to me one time. He had, I don't know, he's so funny. And now we're really comfortable with each other. So he doesn't try to pull that on me so much because I'm always waiting for it. But I would tease him a lot because his eye line tended to be kind of at my chest level. And a lot of my costumes were very low cut. You know, I know in Star Trek we had Deanna Troi. She was kind of the Counselor Cleavage on Next Generation. And I kind of felt like I was Counselor Cleavage on our show. You know, I had my tits hanging out all the time. And Walter kept, you know, he kind of never looked me in the eye. And the crew would just start laughing because, you know, Walter would be having these intense conversations with my breasts. And, you know, I'm a very tall girl, and I'm bigger than he is. So it was kind of, it's just the way his eye line felt. And maybe I'm not being fair to him, but he's kind of going, hey, Walter, up here, dude.
Yeah, right.
Can you tell us a little bit about the practical joke he played on you?
We were going to a convention, and I had never met this particular convention promoter before. And he said, have you ever, I can't remember the name, I'm just going to say the guy's name was John. He said, have you ever met John before? And I said, oh, no, I haven't. I'm looking forward to it. And he goes, well, whatever you do, just don't stare. And I said, what do you mean don't stare? And he said, oh, well, my God, they didn't tell you. He's got this huge carbuncle on the side of his nose. It's really unfortunate. And I don't know why he hasn't taken care of it, but it's terrible. And you know, it's practically like a second head. And it's just, I mean, he went on, and we had like this 5.5 hour flight, you know, he just went on about it. And I was like, oh my God, the poor man. Oh my God. I mean, oh, you're kidding. Okay. No, I won't stare. I promise. Okay. All right. I'm going to be so cool. And of course I meet the man, he picks us up at the airport and he's totally normal looking. And I'm looking at him and I don't even realize my face is doing anything. And John says to me, did Walter tell you that I have something wrong with my face? Because he knew Walter very well.
Oh, man.
And that was the start of the weekend. I had to endure the whole weekend of that kind of stuff going on. But after that, I was Walter-proofed. Anyway, yeah, I've been indoctrinated, so I was fine.
What do you think, in your mind, what happened to Lita at the end of the 5 years? Do you have your own story for what happened to her?
I got to go off. Yeah, I mean, I got to go off with Shakaar, you know? I got to leave. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, afterwards, you know, did you write out what, you know, what sort of adventures took place? Or, you know, there supposedly Lita was instrumental in the downfall of the Psi-Corp, and she dies in taking out their facilities on Mars. But other than that, it's really been a complete and utter mystery.
I didn't go too far into it because I thought that, I mean, Joe has that world so well thought out that I'm sure when he chooses to reveal it, if he chooses to, it'll be amazing. I kind of assume, well, you know, my first experience with Babylon 5, other than that audition that I just told you about, was we go through what's called a callback situation, in which the Joe and Doug Netter and John and our casting person and Richard Copeland, our director, picked the actors they wanted, and then they put us in front of the suits from Warner Brothers, all the executives from Warner Brothers who were going to have a say in this cast. And I auditioned at that point with Andreas Katsoulis. We did the Lita Jakar scene where he asks me what my pleasure threshold is.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And I'm left just staring at him like a little Bambi, you know, Bambi with a gun, just going, what the heck is going on here? And my last scene is leaving with Jakar. So I figure they are exploring that whole pleasure threshold principle and having a good time in space by themselves. And they probably have some adventures on the way, and then he eventually probably drops her off so that she can do what she's got to do at the Psy Corps. But I'd like to think that Lita and Jakar had a good long spell of just fun for the two of them for a while. I think they earned it.
Yes.
I would agree with that. So as you know, unfortunately, Andreas passed away on Monday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have any reminiscences about Mr. Katsoulis that you think sums up the kind of person he was that you can share with us?
As a cast, we've had a terrible couple years. And we lost Richard, we lost Tim Choate, and we've lost Andreas, and it's just horrible and kind of I'm really very numb at this moment, and we've been emailing each other back and forth and talking on the phone, and we're going to get together on Sunday and just hang out because I think everybody's just raw. We knew Andreas was very sick for a long time, unlike Richard, who died so completely unexpectedly, but nonetheless, when it happens, I don't think, even though you think you're prepared, because we knew it was terminal for a long time, it's just nothing like the finality of having them gone, knowing that they're off the planet. And Andreas was, a tremendous person to work with and to have on the set. There are actors who are very, you've heard stories. I mean, there's actors of every single type as there are in life, you know, every kind of person. So when you're working in this little microcosm of a world and you're working together 18 hours a day, you see each other more than you do your own families. And those personality tributes can be kind of accentuated or exasperated and, you know, blown out of proportion after you get sick of each other. But the incredible thing about Babylon 5 is that we really never did. We never got tired of each other. And Andreas was a big contributor to the fun on the set. He was always impeccably polite and sweet and darling to be around. He always said that when he had his Jakar head on and his red eyes in, he felt attractive in a way that he never did in life normally. He always had women hanging around him. There'd be the women from the cast, obviously, we would always love to hang out and talk with him, but he also had, like, whoever were the extras that day or whoever the office personnel would come back and talk to him. I mean, he just had this charisma about him. We called him, you know, the Frank Sinatra was Old Blue Eyes. We called him Old Red Eyes because he just had that kind of thing, joie de vivre about with women. Women loved Jakar. Very, very powerful and sexual and fun, just in a fun way, a harmless way. You know, there was nothing offensive about it. He was just lovely. And he was also just a guy's guy. You know, he could hang around and Richard, Jerry, Bruce, those guys could be, boy, they pulled no punches, and Andreas could hang there with it and take it and give it out just with the best of them. It was, He was amazing, just amazing. They're all really, you know, we were really, really lucky. We were really lucky to have gotten to know him and spent time around him like that.
Yeah, I honestly cannot imagine another actor putting as much heart and soul, mm-hmm. you know, bringing that Jakar character to life with such depth.
Right. There was something, he was made to be, he was made for that part. And Joe then, one of Joe's many gifts is that he could, when he had the actor in place and he got to see what the actors could do, he'd start to write for the actor as the character. So he really wrote Andreas as Jakar, you know. I think a good example of that is Claudia Christian. When you meet her, you don't necessarily know that she is hysterically funny. And especially when she's auditioning for the second in command of a space station, you know, it's not necessarily a laugh riot kind of audition. But as Joe got to know Claudia, she's hysterically funny. She's smart as a whip. And he started to write to that so that we could see Ivanova with this amazing sense of humor and really have Claudia play with the comedy a little more.
I think one of my favorite scenes for Claudia, of course, is the intimate sex scene with Lou Motti.
Exactly. Well, after he got to know her, he wrote that for her. So that's how he, you know, I think also that Jakar was, Andreas was so completely in that character is because Joe designed it around Andreas. He was so perfect. And then Peter, Andreas, the chemistry between the two of them, you know, Joe just kept that going and worked with it. He found gold and he knew it and he cultivated it.
That was an amazing relationship between those two characters from where they started to where they ended up.
Mm-hmm. And they were best friends up until the end of Andreas' life. Peter's really devastated right now. Peter is just shocked and sad, and he's dealing with it, but it's a big loss for Peter.
Was there ever a moment on the show where you felt like that was the moment where Joe Straczynski had captured your essence as Lita Alexander? You had mentioned that earlier with Claudia Christian. And, of course, Lewis, is there a time when you got a script and you just said, oh, this is it?
No, I don't think I do. I don't think I feel that way. I mean, maybe on the outside people can see it. It's hard to be that objective for myself. I think that I did start, he did start using maybe some of my strength a little bit more in the fifth season. Letting Lita play with her power, you know, and being a little more secure, that was nice. I started to feel more centered. But I think that was part of what was kind of intrinsic to the character of Lita is that she is so off balance for all those years on B5, right? I mean, when she comes back to the station, she's been messed with in a major way and doesn't even know how or why and has blackout periods. And so it was a disconcerting person to be, that's for sure. And I don't think that I'd hate to think that anyone thought that was anything like my life.
Well, that is an interesting part, I think, of Lita's story. To take it all the way from the beginning of the gathering, that scene you were talking earlier where Jakar is basically propositioning Lita.
Yeah, totally.
And you know, she's thoroughly shocked and offended, and that's understandable. But when she gets through everything that she's gone through and you think about all that that she had sacrificed and done for the Army of Light and into the fifth year where Byron's people comes along, you know, and she's beginning to realize or beginning to feel that she'd been used and, you know, everybody was utilizing her abilities, but nobody's coming around to just kind of say thanks and buy her a drink. That last scene where she is telling Jakar, you know, when we first met, you propositioned me, you know, I was thinking about that actually today. And it occurred to me that Lita had been so dehumanized that she was willing to come back down around to that. She had felt so completely dehumanized that she was willing to say, hey, whatever, I want to get out of here, and you're leaving, and if this is the price I got to pay to get the hell out of here, then I'll pay it. You know,
right.
And again, to Andreas Katsula's great strength, his response is this amazing embarrassment that, you know, his character had come so far that he's sitting there thinking, you know, oh, I can't believe I had ever done that. You know, I mean, I'm just sitting there watching. It's you know, Babylon 5 is so full of powerful character moments, and that's one of them. You know, the whole thing comes 360, and yet it's in a whole different place. And you know, it's just amazing to watch.
Well, thank you. It's amazing how many times I run into people who still are very moved by it. I just did a play in Pittsburgh, and I got back about a week ago. While I was there, I had people coming up to me every single day saying who just happened to see me in the street or whatever and say, oh, I loved Babylon 5. And a lot of them were very young people, so they weren't watching when it was first airing. They're watching the DVDs now. And I was just so honored by that and thrilled to be a part of a show that had a life like that, you know, that still affects people. I was with my son in Italy 2 summers ago, and we were on a boat in the middle of nowhere and had people coming up to us and speaking Italian and saying Babylon 5. And it was just mind-blowing, you know. Very sweet. And it's just a tribute, like you said, I think, to Joe for having written characters that have a real sort of a real journey, you know. Nobody is 100% good. No one's 100% bad. There's something likable about each of them, and there's something hateful about each of them, or at least irritating. And, you know, he was able to write these great storylines, and then he found the right actors to do it. It was an extraordinary experience. And I got a great email from Claudia yesterday saying something like, wasn't that amazing? Weren't we lucky?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, and the longer we're out there and the more shows we work on, we realize it was completely extraordinary and probably will never happen again.
Well, we're really lucky as fans to be able to have witnessed such a thing.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Yes, we are.
Sweet thing to say. Thank you. I mean, you know, and I'm grateful for the families of Rick and Andreas and Tim that they had such nice characters and they had such a great ride. That those images are going to keep going and going and going. At least it's something, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about what projects you're currently working on or what's coming up in the near future that we can see you in?
Well, the journey of an actor is never over. You know, I just finished one. I'm on something else, or I'm waiting to hear. And it's hard. You know, I was talking to a casting director a couple weeks ago, and she said, I think this is just a business of rejection, and I try to help actors deal with that, to understand that. I mean, it's extraordinary how much we just have to take and how many times we get turned down. Felicity Huffman said something on the Golden Globes, and it actually kind of irritated me. She was saying, I didn't work for a year, and you know, I never thought I'd get up here. I thought, oh, shut up. Didn't work for a year? Try 6 years. Try 7 years, you know? I mean, the rest of us journeyman actors, we're lucky if we get a job every once in a while, you know? That is the most arrogant thing to say. Because most actors who are in the Screen Actors Guild, like myself, we make a living acting. But it's a struggle. You know, I mean, if we're lucky if we make enough to get our insurance. We're lucky to make $30,000 a year. It's a big deal to us to be able to make our insurance. But yet, that's most of what you see are those people. 90% of the actors you see in cable on TV are in that range of just barely making a living.
So why do you do that?
They're still doing it. Well, I can't do anything else, unfortunately. It's the only thing I have ever wanted to do. It's the only thing I can do. Believe me, I try all kinds of things. I've tried everything. And I've worked now while I'm auditioning, I'm also working with actors, helping them improve their audition techniques and getting them in front of other, using my connections and getting actors in front of casting directors, talking to the people I know that work, just to keep, you know, we all need help. We all need mentorship. It doesn't matter what field you're in. It really would be nice to have somebody who could give you some helpful hints along the way, right? Don't we all wish that we had somebody help us along in life? Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Are you mentoring any stunt people too?
I'm not as involved in the stunt industry these days, and I have helped some stunt folks along. I'm happy to, and I am in touch with stunt people, but mostly I sort of give them a phone number to go call somebody else who's more, you know, active in stunts. I only work for the guys who know me, who call me. The stunt coordinator is a friend of mine who worked on the Star Trek shows, you know, Dennis Matalone. He's now working Without a Trace, so mm-hmm. I work over there every once in a while, or work for a friend of his, or I worked on Bewitched because I knew that guy. You know what I mean? So if it's someone I know, great, but I'm not out there trying to get the stunt jobs. You know, I'm in my late 40s now, and it hurts.
Was there any
I want to do other things.
Was there any young actor on B5 that you mentored that's now gone on to do?
We were all young on B5. We were all young on B5. I'm trying to think. I'm still friends with a lot of the younger crew folks. Most of the actors are doing just fine. You know, I mean, we're all in the same boat. I'm mostly working with people even younger than that. So,
now,
you know, or people who just want, you know, it doesn't matter what age they are. I don't, really don't even know the ages of people.
Yeah. Jeffrey had mentioned that you guys were going to a convention in Italy in a couple of months. Can you give us any details about that? Because he didn't remember them.
No. Okay. It's a small convention in Fiuggi, Italy, Fiuggi Fontana, which is a spa town about an hour outside Rome. And I don't know a whole lot about it, so I'm really traveling on faith here. Not the UK, because the UK has got very organized science fiction conventions. But the rest of Europe, it's a little different. They're not as fan-oriented. They want to meet us. They might buy a picture or something, or have you sign something, but it's not the collector mania that occurs in the United States and in the UK. So it's a much more low-key kind of thing. But I love Italy, and I'll go any chance I can get, so I'm kind of excited to.
Do you know what dates those are?
I believe it's March 23rd. Is that weekend, March 23rd, 24th, 25th, something like that.
Okay.
That third weekend. So it's coming up pretty soon. Oy. And then I'm going to be in England too at the end of April, beginning of May, in Birminghamshire. There's a Collector Mania 9 or something like that. That's where I'm going. I'm real helpful on it. I think I'm going to be somewhere, and they speak another language, and I'm just going to go. So,
is there any other actor on Babylon 5 that you have wished you had more screen time with?
Peter Jurasik. I had a lot of time with Rick, and I had a good amount of time with Andreas. I think it was, our storylines were perfect. You know, we didn't interconnect until the end again, which is really, really right on. But I would have loved to work with Peter more. Yeah. Claudia and I had some good times, and so did Mira and I, but I would have loved to work with Peter some more. I don't know what Londo and Leto would be up to, but it might have been kind of interesting.
Well, you know, Centauri have six.
So I hear. Even though Leto was a little shut down until the end there, I don't know. Kind of scary, huh? And
what
they're prehensile.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's right. They are. They certainly are.
You.
Candy at cards.
I mean, you're bad enough as it is, much less being able to move on their own. No.
The mind wanders.
Oh. Oh, I need a drink now. Whoa.
We had an interview with Bear Burge, the prop master, prop
friend. I love Bear. Isn't he great?
He was wonderful to talk with.
He's a cracker.
He told us some of the things that some of the actors walked away with when this show finally wrapped. And I'm just curious to know what you might have grabbed out of the prop cage.
I didn't get anything. You know, Bear made me... I was not very savvy, was I? I should have, you know, chewed off a piece of the med lab or something, but I didn't. I didn't get anything. I didn't get anything. Not even my own hair pieces I didn't get. I didn't get anything. I would have liked more of my costumes. My God, I would have liked kept my costumes. They made my costumes for me, and they probably got thrown out or something, you know? Nobody else would care. I wish I kept those. I don't know. I don't know what else. I took a lot of pictures. I think my biggest treasure are my photographs from that time. You know, I have great pictures. I have pictures of people being ridiculous. I have pictures I'll never show anyone. But I have some really great ones, too. And those are treasured to me. I have pictures of my son, for instance, when he was I think he was 2 and a half, and it was Halloween. And he's wearing a little devil costume. And I had him give out candy to all the aliens in Babylon 5. He grew up with these aliens for 5 years. He never knew what Bill Mumy or Andreas or he never knew what they looked like. You know, he only saw them in full makeup until afterwards. You know, now he knows. But at the time, it was pretty funny. I love those pictures. It's very sweet. I have a great picture of Andrea Thompson holding Julian when he was 5 months old when we were shooting the episode where she leaves. You know, I love it. It's nice to have those things because I remember then everything that happened around that day, around the time we took the picture. Are you pondering that?
Trying to figure out a way to convince you to share some of those pictures with us.
I guess we'll talk to Jeffrey and how that would work.
Okay.
Yeah, because they're not digital. They're all, you know, real film photos. I didn't have a digital camera. So it's not as easy.
Anybody had a digital camera then.
My friend Kurt did. Our on-set prop guy, Kurt DePhillips, mm-hmm. He did. He just sent me a few of him, of me and Andreas today. And they're really sweet. I have a really sweet one of Andreas and I. He was outside having a cigarette. Oh, shit. Right?
Yeah,
it's a good ad for not smoking, folks. Yeah. Lung cancer. It's a bitch.
Yes, it is.
But he was always outside having a cigarette, and you know, the girls would go outside to flirt with him. So I have pictures of him during the pilot, during the gathering, and it's great to have. I love having our pictures. So what else, you guys?
I have one last question for you. On your website...
Sure.
And since you were talking about mentoring, you name drop Charles Nelson Reilly.
Yeah, Charles,
now,
a great guy.
I was going to say, I remember Charles Nelson Reilly from the Sid and Marty Krofft Saturday morning show.
Oh,
still,
sure.
Which is like one of the most things ever created.
I know. So really, these guys were tripping big time, weren't they?
artists.
Charles he had that television personality that everybody knew. That's where he made his money. But he also studied serious acting with Herbert Berghoff and Stella Adler. I mean, he was a very intense, incredible actor. He didn't get to do that much because he got famous for being so funny.
Right.
But he's also a wonderful director and teacher, and he had an acting studio for a while here in LA, and I was fortunate enough to be a part of that. He really sort of saved my butt in that horrible time from after doing the pilot for Babylon 5 to getting, you know, bumped off the series before I got brought back. I just sort of, I took a step back out of acting. I thought this is the business of acting, and it's brutal and it's hideous, and it's not why I just wanted to do this. So I just stuck to my acting class, and I did a lot of stunt work, and I did some of the biggest shows I've ever done, ever, working with Spielberg and Zemeckis and, you know, some great shows as a stunt woman. But I just stayed in the acting class, and he nurtured me along and just made me feel like made me feel like a wonderful actress and validated me. And I got to work with other great actors. And it was a very important couple of years for me to get back to my roots as an actor and to mature myself, sort of hone my skills. And Charles was, I can't say enough, just he was such a loving, yet no bullshit. He didn't pull any punches. If you were not telling the truth on stage, he would start talking to you in the middle of your thing. What are you doing? But I don't see what you're doing. And then I mean, to act the class with Charles was an experience all unto itself. He said, "Oh, she's very good, isn't she? She's so good." Amazing. If you got through class with Charles, you really were some kind of an actor. Yeah, and he's directing a lot of opera these days. Plus, he had his one-man show. Did you hear about that?
No, I didn't.
One-man show. HBO shot it. Yeah, so I'm hoping we'll be seeing a little more of Charles soon.
Okay. I would like to thank you for sharing so much time with us tonight.
Oh, you're so sweet. My pleasure. Absolutely. You know, like I said, I really feel it's an honor that people want to talk about Babylon 5, and we're grateful for the continued interest, and I know the Babylon 5 actors are always happy to talk to fans. So it's just part of giving back and being grateful, you know?
thank you so much, and I'm actually looking forward. We will be calling you again in the future. Trust me.
Okay. All right. Okay. More questions. Maybe we can plan it next time.
Yeah. I'm hoping, like, we'll go through everybody, you know, everybody in the cast and crew once as a surprise,
yes.
And then we'll start planning more. There we go.
Okay.
That should make Jeff happy.
We love Citroën Page. Nobody likes you. Evers, my friend. Michaelis Tricks. Wicked. False, not evil. Evil takes care of us. Where would you be without Michael? Go to DragonPage.com and never come back. What did you say? Go to DragonPage.com and never come back.
Wow, that was a fun interview.
She was very talkative. That made our job a lot easier, I think.
I think it's because she had so much fun on the series and just wanted to tell everybody, hey, I had fun. Go watch more.
And she had a lot of great insights, I think, not only in her character, but other aspects of the show as well. And it sounds like she was the kind of person, the kind of actor who wasn't just hanging out in a trailer or hobnobbing with only just the actors. It sounds like she was, you know, talking with the crew and getting involved with the crew as well. And that just sounds like a real special thing to be around.
It sounds like Babylon 5, it was really one of those special family type sets where everybody got to know everybody. Everyone loved hanging out with everyone. It wasn't everybody was a diva and they had their own separate trailers where they isolated themselves away from everybody until it was, you know, their time to be called on the set to record.
One of the things that I've read in various magazines was that because of where the sets were located in like an abandoned hot tub manufacturing plant or something like that, the fact that they were away from the normal auspices of the studio system, that they were their own little world, not only fictionally, but in reality. That sounded like that really helped reinforce that sense of community.
That sounds good to me.
So let's talk about The Gathering. This, of course, was the pilot for Babylon 5. As you just heard our interview with Pat Tallman, she was in that pilot and then was cut by the suits at Warner Brothers. Anyway, the pilot, as you know, was the kickoff for Babylon 5. The story is that apparently the station is been active for some time, but not fully operational. They're waiting for the ambassador from the Vorlon Empire to show up. A mysterious man arrives aboard the station. When Ambassador Kosh arrives, he is discovered to have been poisoned, and then the mystery ensues because Lena Alexander, doing a telepathic scan of the Vorlon ambassador, discovers that Commander Jeffrey Sinclair is the person who slapped the poison tab onto the Vorlon's hand. And then, of course, the rest of the show is Sinclair trying to clear his name, trying to discover the mystery of who would frame Sinclair, and setting everything right. Does that sum it up, Summer? What do you think?
Sounds good to me. Now, I have... It really struck me the differences between the original Japanese... the original version that I saw on the Japanese Laserdisc and the re-edited version from TNT. I remember seeing an interview with JMS, the great maker, when the series moved to TNT. They were going to do In the Beginning and The Gathering. And they said, hey, would you like to re-edit, you know, any of this for our broadcast? And JMS said, sure. So he did. There were a lot of significant changes. Londo's intro at the beginning in the original pilot focused on Del Varner. Like, it put the focus on him and made it seem like his mission was to destroy Babylon 5's credibility before they had a chance to get started. Another major point, it seemed in the original pilot that literally Babylon 5 was throwing its doors open for the first time, but in the re-edited version, it seemed like they'd been there for almost a year and were just, you know, everything was starting, you know, they were confident that everything was smooth running and were just, you know, finishing up inviting the diplomatic corps on board. Like, the diplomats had been coming on for the past month and then everything was going to start going.
I'm not having access to an original version, but having seen that original version at some point, you know, I was going strictly on memory. I didn't have your pristine copy of Laserdisc to go by, Summer. But those were some of my recollections too. Was that change in Londo's voiceover? Like you said, the sense of had the station just opening versus having been online for some time. Some of the other more notable changes, of course, was the really bogus overdub for Delenn's voice. You know, that story, of course, was that Delenn was supposed to be completely neutered, or sexless, I guess, rather, and part of the double whammy at the end of the first year and beginning of the second year,
right,
was that not only was she transformed into a human, but she was transformed into a human woman.
Right.
And then watching the TNT version, they did away with that overdub. So you had Mira Furlan's lovely voice and this kind of bizarre creature delivering the lines. That, I think, was even more jarring than the bad voiceover.
Yeah, and another thing that it was actually probably a good edit. They had mentioned it online a couple times. The new version didn't show the alien sector as being some sort of zoo with the glass doors where you could see into the alien residence quarters. in the edited
right.
version, you just saw Sinclair and Lita walking out just as if they'd, you know, cut through a back hallway or something. But in the original version, he's actually stopping to point out certain aliens, and like the doors are clear, so it's like looking into their rooms.
I'm going through the Lurker's Guide trying to glean some insights. There was a post there, I guess off the Usenet group that JMS was involved with, where he talks about the reason they went with that was the idea that these were aliens, and so their social mores would be different than ours. And that got me to thinking that even though, to a certain logical sense, that makes sense, you know, they're aliens, so, you know, why would they be living the same way we live? It gets back to that old bugaboo that you're still dealing with 20th century, 21st century human beings and how they relate to the images.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of funny.
So, whereas in a logical sense, what JMS was trying to achieve made sense, like a zoo.
Yes. And I'm looking at my notes here. Yes. We Lieutenant Commander Takashima. I didn't remember that there was actually a difference in the argument.
What was your take?
Well, no, she had a, there was an argument she had with Jakar in CNC. Remember that argument? Where they were talking about having, you know, the Narn supply ship
rate? I do remember that.
All right. In the original version, she's all like sultry, sexy, apologetic, and in the TNT version, she's, you know, in command, she's military, and she's pissed that he's getting in her face about it. Very, very different takes. Same words, different deliveries. Completely different.
What was your take on her character, Chris, that played Lieutenant Commander Takashima?
Her character seemed standoffish and conspiratorial at the same time. The fact that she was willing to take the responsibility for something without telling the commander. You know, she's like, yeah, I've got a the conspiracy with the doctor, Dr. Klein, Kyle, to scan Akash.
Right.
That, I don't know, that seemed kind of out of character for someone who we should want to trust. And I don't, something about the way that was delivered, it didn't inspire trust in me.
In that same scene, I found it kind of interesting where she talks about the first she offers Dr. Kyle the cup of coffee and mentions conspiratorially that she's got one of the hydroponics guys growing her plants, and so she gets every few months fresh beans. But in the same monologue, she goes on to talk about how Commander Sinclair brought her aboard because he convinced her to play by the rules, and she hadn't broken the rules in a long time, and she was due. Wait a minute, you were just telling him that you were breaking the rules.
Well, there's a different rules. There are rules, and then there are rules. You know, she was used to breaking the big rules, and so now she's like, yeah, I need to break a few more rules now, so we might as well start rolling right here. That just
Now, the understanding from what I read is that down the line, had Laurel stayed on the show, she would, in essence, have been the character of Jack, Garibaldi's aide that shoots him in the back and
right.
is involved
yes.
in the assassination of the president.
Right.
And there are sort of hints that are kind of dropped in there. But somehow, whether it's the actress or just how it was written, I wasn't particularly convinced in her delivery that she was the kind of person that was going to be able to get away with something like that.
Really?
Yeah, there was just something. I think one of the problems I had with her character is that some of the times when she was getting very stern and commanding, that it really came off as wooden. And not, you know, not particularly believable. That to me were places where the show itself fell down.
Mm-hmm. No, I can see where someone in her position would be perfectly placed to take advantage of certain things to help set up the conspiracy to assassinate the president. And I don't know, maybe it was just the way that was written. It seemed like you really didn't trust her, because I don't remember seeing any scenes where Sinclair confided in her the way we saw Sheridan confide in Ivanova later, you know?
You're right about that. Now, how much of that is simply a function of this episode being the pilot, and that would have been something that would have played out in a future episode, or how much of that was really part of the plan that JMS was setting up, you know, the dominoes that we're going to be knocked over later on. There's really no way of telling at this point.
Maybe, but I mean, we saw enough interaction between Sinclair and Garibaldi to know that they had a rapport. We never got to see even a hint of that between Sinclair and Takashima.
No, I'll agree with you on that one. Let's get to the next big plot point. The assassination attempt on Ambassador Kosh. What's your take on all that, not only in terms of the show and the five-year arc that was told in Babylon 5, but just from a storytelling point of view, how do you think it worked?
I have a couple of issues with it, believe it or not.
I have many issues, but I'll let you go first.
Okay. first of all, later on, we find out that the Vorlons are these mysterious, super powerful people. One of the first things that they say is, any ship sent into Vorlon space is never heard from again, yet someone's going to try to poison him. That's their big plan, to like hope that you can get a hand inside of his encounter suit before he zaps you to stick a poison tab on him someplace. You don't even know what he looks like. How do you know what the poison, how do you know poison's going to work on him? Because you don't know what kind of creature, you know, composition, body composition you're dealing with. And that's what I had a problem with later. They're doing all these scans saying that they've isolated the compound. I was like, well, how can you do that? Because they didn't give you any biological information on the Vorlons in the first place. What did you isolate and how? That just bugged me. So, you know, especially if the, yeah, if the Minbari is going to do the assassination, then why wouldn't he be more overt, trying to shoot him or something?
The other bit of that that always made me wonder, we talked to Dr. Kyle, what did you see? We talked to Lena Alexander, what did you see? But there's like three or four med techs poking around in that room too. Did they not even kind of peek down the little opening in the middle of his suit, and did anybody talk to them about what was going on? That was another thing that was bothersome. That and the glowing hand when the assassin disguised as Sinclair shows up. You know, I've been trying to think of it in terms of looking at it from the worldview. If I was in the Babylon 5 universe, how would this make sense? And every explanation I come up with is just so far-fetched that it really boils down to, I think, I have to say it, it's bad storytelling. You know, were the Vorlons in cahoots with this Minbari, even though he was part of a renegade warrior clan? Were they in cahoots as a test for Sinclair to see how he would handle such a crisis? If so, there's got to be a better way than sneaking a guy on with a changeling net through a Narn vessel disguised as the commander, and then extending the glowing hand so that the telepath can come along and reveal the plot and frame the commander. You know, it gets just so convoluted that it really ultimately doesn't make any sense.
And believe it or not, the glowing hand was added. So that kind of made it worse, because in the original pilot, the original version of it, Lita says, I'm going to see everything from my point of view. And then when you see she's inside, it's actually her hand reaching out to Sinclair to shake it, and there's no dialogue between them. It's just like a greeting, and then all of a sudden, you know, the fake Sinclair grabs the hand and slaps the poison tab on it. In the edited version, the hand is glowy, and we actually hear Kosh's voice say, Entelza Velen, which right. That was added too.
Ah, very interesting.
Yeah.
So in that case, if the Vorlons are all knowing, it's hard to imagine that they'd be fooled by a guy in a changeling net.
They're supposed to be mildly telepathic. So how do you fall for that?
Right, exactly. And that gets back to the whole thing. Maybe they were in cahoots and so forth, so on, and then we're back to chasing rabbits down the hole again.
Mm-hmm. But if we believe... go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I also have a big problem with a changeling net, but I think you have a thought to finish on this, the Kosh assassination attempt, mm-hmm. So you go ahead.
Well, if we believe what we saw in the beginning, which is supposed to take place before the gathering, the Vorlons already know that Sinclair is the reincarnation of Valen, which is why we had the edited version in the added touch in the new pilot. Why they knew who he was? Why go through this whole rigmarole of wanting him extradited to the Vorlon homeworld for trial?
Right, like I say, it may be. You can explain it away as a test to Sinclair's character. If he is truly Valen, then he would find a way through this and dig deep into himself to face this trial and tribulation. But you know, Occam's razor has a great value in this sort of thing. You know, the simplest way is the best way. Even if you look later on, you've got Sebastian the Inquisitor. Wouldn't it have been more effective to
send him in? Yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly. So it was just so convoluted that, you know, I'm not sure what Straczynski was thinking when he wrote it, frankly.
I think he was, I can pretty much imagine he was trying to get as much information that would set the groundwork for the 5-year series in a 2-hour movie without losing too much of the audience. But I wonder how much of the plot inconsistencies actually hurt the potential audiences, which is another reason why people didn't come back to the series until, you know, second season, middle of first season, and go, oh, wow, what happened here?
Right. What did I miss? Yeah, I agree with you. the other thing that I had a big issue was with the changeling net. You want to talk about your hoary cliches in science fiction. That's one of them, you know, whether it's the technology is kind of novel, the suit that you wear that changes you, but it gets back to the whole problem of the body double and everybody being fooled by some guy walking around who looks and talks like Commander Sinclair. But, you know, as an audience member, I don't know the character too well. This is the pilot. I can tell right away who's the bogus Sinclair or the bogus Lita or whoever. So these people who have had more contact in this universe with this person, they can't figure it out?
Well, the bogus Lita, I can understand because she just got on the station. Nobody knows her, really. She's just kind of wandering around, wanders into med lab, and starts breaking stuff up. The bogus Sinclair, you know, Kosh has never met him. He just knows who he is. I don't think he ever met anybody else as the fake Sinclair. So I don't know if anybody ever saw him. As for Del Varner, anything's possible. And the one guy who recognized him got killed. So.
Fair enough. I'll see that point, although I still think it's a pretty lousy plot device to get an assassin into place.
Yeah, well, we can play rock, paper, scissors on it later.
This other convolution to try to make the assassination of an energy being. Fair enough.
Okay, and with that, we're actually going to break here and continue our discussion of The Gathering next episode, because we have voicemails to get through and a tribute to the late, great Andreas Katsoulis.
From the worlds between the pages of your favorite book, to adventures teetering on the edge of the dice. The pilot's at the helm and our course is set. The dream ship gathers speed across the sea of possibilities. Welcome aboard, the Dragonhearth.
I'm Tracy Hickman.
And I'm Laura Hickman. Each month we explore the limitless expanse of creative fiction and games, from the nuts and bolts of writing and publishing to the worlds of our creation.
Whether you're looking for practical advice on plot, character, and setting, or in search of new and distant realms of speculative fiction to explore, you'll find a home here on Dragonhearth.
Join our next voyage through your favorite RSS server or by visiting us at dragonhearthproductions.com. Tracy and Laura Hickman's Dragonhearth, voyages into the realms of imagination.
Hello, this is Walter from LA. I just wanted to call to just say I'm really excited about this Babylon 5 podcast. I can't wait to hear where you guys go with it. I don't have suggestions right off the top of my head, but I will. Looking forward to it. Glad you guys are doing it. Thank you for doing it. I'm really looking forward to an analysis of the storylines, the threads that went throughout all the seasons, because the show is just absolutely amazing. So. Thank you, and I'll be listening. Bye.
Well, thank you, Walter, and hopefully we will continue to provide more content that you will find interesting.
I think even though we're going to be doing pretty much episode by episode analysis. At some point in the conversation, we will be dealing with the overall thread. So you can hear that in our interview with Pat Tallman. Even we went from The Gathering all the way to, I guess it's Objects in Motion, one of the last episodes ever of the show. So we can't help but cover it all at any given point.
Objects at Rest.
Thank you.
Yeah, hi. This is Harald from the northern part of Norway. I just want to say thank you for doing this great podcast show. And it's fantastic that someone finally has made it possible to discuss Babylon 5 and making it available to the fans out there in the world. I have all the 5 seasons of Babylon 5 on DVD, and I watch them constantly. And I don't know how many times I have watched them. And now I can listen to the actors and so on. It's great. Thank you.
Wow, our first caller from Norway. That is so cool.
That is really neat. It's great to know that we're reaching fans across the globe. And again, you know, we've talked about this before, Summer. I think it's pretty amazing that nobody else has done a B5 podcast. I mean, even with as new as podcasting is in the grand scheme of things, it's just kind of surprising that nobody's thought of doing it first.
Mm-hmm. And I think it actually speaks to the power of the overall story of B5, that it touched so many people, it attracted so many fans in so many different countries and so many different cultures. Everybody gets it, and I think that's one of the most amazing things to me, the most amazing tributes out there to the entire series.
Yeah, there's a universality there that few shows ever achieve, no doubt.
And as Pat mentioned, we lost Andreas Katsoulis earlier this week, who portrayed Jakar, and he was the third character that we've lost from B5.
That's right. Richard Biggs, who played Dr. Franklin, and Tim Choate, is that how it's pronounced?
Yes.
Who was the wonderful Zathras.
Yes.
And unfortunately now, Andreas Katsoulis, who played Jakar.
And as I said before, his performance, his skills, talents as an actor really gave Jakar that voice, that heart, that depth of character that I can't even begin to think of a different actor who could have provided that.
Right. Summer, what would you say was your favorite Jakar moment?
I have actually two. The scene where he's defiant, standing up in the council room after the Narn homeworld has been besieged, and he says, "We taught them this lesson before, we'll teach it to them again." And later on, it's not actually a scene of his, but his voiceover doing the Declaration of Principles from Season 5, the We Are One speech, which I think is just amazing. I mean, I realize that JMS wrote that, but the poignancy with which he read that just got to me.
Sure. I think one of the things that I have enjoyed that I go back to is the scene where right after Jakar has attacked Londo and he's in prison after the dust incident and he has his revelation and sees Jaquan, Garibaldi goes to visit him and of course tells him that, you know, the other prisoners want him to stop singing, and he's laughing. But I guess get to talking about the book that Jakar's writing. And, you know, Garibaldi holds out the Book of Jaquan and says, "Here, you might want this." And, you know, he does the little reverential salute, the Narn salute, but it hands it back and says, "No, you hold on to it. Besides, I'm considerably closer to the source now."
Mm-hmm.
And then later, as they're talking and talking about the book that Jakar is going to write, and Garibaldi says, "Can I see it?" And there's just that look in his eye where he sinks back into the shadows in his bunk and he goes, "In good time."
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, so simple. There's no real great demonstrative thing going on there, but he communicates so much with such little gestures and just the look of the eye. It's just really incredible to see. And as Pat said before, it's all on DVD, and it's wonderful that we get to relive it over and over again.
And I think my favorite comedic moment from him was the whole scene where he's teaching the other Narn out of the Book of Jakar, and he's trying to deal very, very patiently, you know, with this one guy, and he says, "Put your face in the book."
Yes. And then Talon's like, "That's in the letter."
Oh, that's just, I literally tear up laughing every time I see that.
Yeah, that's a good one. One of my favorite comedic moments revolves around the Declaration of Principles, where Jakar is constantly trying to write it, and he finally has it written, and I think Sheridan reads part of it, and then Jakar comes in, it's late at night, and he says, "I've changed it." He says, "What do you mean you've changed it again?
Yeah.
It's better," and he runs out, and then Sheridan reads and goes, "It is better."
Yeah. And they running out, he's like, "Do you have any idea what it took for us to get all of them to sign it?" He says, "Not to worry, not to worry." And he just grabs up the copies and runs away to give the other ambassadors new copies to sign.
Right.
That was classic. All right.
It's priceless stuff.
That will do it for this episode of the Babylon Podcast. You can reach us via email at babylonpodcast@gmail.com. You can also call, leave a voicemail at 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year the Great War came upon us all.
And if you have your own audio equipment, you can record an MP3 to us and email it to us, and we'll play it.
And thanks to everybody who has been emailing us and leaving comments on the blog. They're great to read, and it's great to know that we're reaching people.
Yeah.
The universe speaks in many languages, but only one voice. The language is not Narn or human or Centauri or Gaim or Minbari. It speaks in the language of hope.
It speaks in the language of trust. It speaks in the language of strength and the language of compassion. It is the language of the heart and the language of the soul. But always it is the same voice. It is the voice of our ancestors speaking through us, and the voice of our inheritors waiting to be born. It is the small, still voice that says, "We are one. No matter the blood, no matter the skin, no matter the world, no matter the star, we are one. No matter the pain, no matter the darkness, no matter the loss, no matter the fear, we are one. Here, gathered together in common cause, we agree to recognize this singular truth and this singular rule, that we must be kind to one another.
Because each voice enriches us and ennobles us, and each voice lost diminishes us. We are the voice of the universe, the soul of creation, the fire that will light the way to a better future. We are one.
We are one.